Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter and Phil Dierking. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a new study suggests that partial doses of the yellow fever vaccine can help protect communities against the disease. The study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It found that individuals given a 1/5 dose of yellow fever vaccine developed enough antibodies to protect them against infection. Aaron Staples was one of the writers of a report on the study. She says this is good news in places where the vaccine is in short supply.
That was the encouraging thing, that this can be done as a potential way when there's supply limitations on the vaccine to help potentially control an outbreak.
Staples works for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, an agency of the United States government. Yellow fever is a serious problem in parts of Africa, as well as Central and South America. People get the disease from infected mosquitoes. The term yellow in the name describes the yellow coloring of some patients' skin. The World Health Organization says a small number of patients develop severe health problems and about half of them die within 7 to 10 days. Staples noted that in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, health workers had to use partial doses of the yellow fever vaccine in 2016. At that time, the vaccine was in short supply. The World Health Organization suggested a 1/5 dose based on some experiments performed in Brazil. Staples said many experts wondered if a partial dosage would be effective against the disease. She noted that nearly 8 million people were targeted for vaccination in the city of Kinshasa.
It worked in small cohorts in a well-controlled clinical trial situation, but when you go to do this large scale in a field, does it work?
The partial amount proved effective. 98% of people tested had protective antibodies to the virus 1 month after being vaccinated. In Brazil, more than 350 people have become sick with yellow fever since late last year. Vaccine supplies remain in short supply. Health officials have launched what they are calling the largest ever partial dose mass vaccination campaign. The goal is to vaccinate nearly 24 million people. Each person is being given a 1/5 dose of the yellow fever vaccine. Staples says the new research offers hope.
You know, I think that's very encouraging for the short-term immediate control. We still need some information about how long immunity will last.
A full dose of yellow fever vaccine provides lifelong protection against the disease. Researchers will continue to study how long people who received partial doses are protected.
Scientists say extreme warm air high over the Arctic Ocean this week is melting sea ice and sending very cold air to Europe. And they say such strange weather may become more common as temperatures continue to rise worldwide. The effects of the warming are clear on Greenland's north coast, where scientists have recorded 61 hours of temperatures above 0 degrees in 2018. That is a record for a place normally frozen at this time of year. And across the Arctic region, temperatures are now 20 degrees Celsius above the average. But far to the south, a rare snowstorm struck Rome, Italy, on Monday. Scientists have suspected for more than 40 years that disappearing sea ice in the Arctic Ocean could make areas to the south colder. Climate scientists even use the phrase warm Arctic, cold continent. Ruth Mottram is a climate scientist at the Danish Meteorological Institute. "It's never been this extreme," she said. Lars Kaleschka is a professor at the University of Hamburg in Germany. He told Reuters that it is unclear how often these warming periods will take place. The question is whether this weather will happen more often. This is just one event, so it's hard to make a causal relationship, he said. Over time, as sea ice melts, more ocean is being exposed. This releases more heat into the atmosphere. The warmer air may, in turn, change the flow of air currents high in the atmosphere, called the jet stream. Nalen Koch is research director at the Norwegian Polar Institute. He said that the jet stream becomes wavier, meaning that colder air can penetrate further south and warmer air further north. The World Meteorological Organization, the UN Weather Agency, says the cold weather in Europe is being caused by a sudden stratospheric warming above the North Pole. This has forced colder air south. Ice in the Arctic Ocean is at its lowest recorded levels for late February. The U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center says about 14 million square kilometers of the ocean is currently covered with ice. That is about 1 million square kilometers less than the long-term average. Scientists have used satellites to observe Arctic ice for more than 30 years. The head of the United Nations Environment Program, Eric Solheim, says the weather shows that Earth's climate is warming. Scientists want to know if the Arctic weather is being driven by human activities or natural forces. Satellite temperature measurements only date back to the late 1970s. The warming temperatures are already causing problems. On the Norwegian island group of Svalbard, temperatures are more than 13 degrees Celsius higher than the long-term average. Svalbard is home to the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, a center aimed at saving plant genetic material for future generations. The seed vault is located there partly because of Svalbard's low temperatures. but unusually warm temperatures could threaten the collection. Mottram of the Danish Meteorological Institute said, Europe's winters have actually become less severe, although this year's temperatures appear low. It's not actually that cold. It's just our perceptions have shifted from a normal winter, she said. I'm Mario Ritter.
Some of the world's oldest cave art is too old to have been made by modern humans, researchers say. Studies suggest that Neanderthals were responsible for creating cave drawings found in modern-day Spain. They also appear to have painted and cut holes in seashells for use as jewelry. Reports on the studies were published in the journals Science and Science Advances. Neanderthals were related to Homo sapiens, the scientific name for modern human beings. Neanderthals lived in Europe and Asia before disappearing about 40,000 years ago. Around that time, scientists believe Homo sapiens arrived in Europe from Africa. Researchers say the new studies provide evidence that the artwork was made about 20,000 years before modern humans came to Europe. The findings were a surprise to Will Rubrics, an expert on Neanderthals. He said it represents a major breakthrough in the field of human evolution studies. Now, he said, Neanderthal ownership of some cave art is a fact. Rubrics, who is not part of either study, is a professor at Leiden University in the Netherlands. Until now, most scientists thought all cave paintings were the work of humans. In the first study, researchers examined artwork in three caves in northern, southern, and west central Spain. They attempted to estimate the age of three paintings. Modern technology has made it easier for scientists to date each painting. They used a process called the uranium-thorium method to estimate the age. The scientists removed small pieces of rock material that had formed on the surface of the artwork and studied them in a laboratory. They found the cave art dates back to 64,000 years ago. Dirk Hoffmann of Germany's Max Planck Institute said the artwork is simple but important for what it represents. He said one work is a collection of lines that look like a ladder. The others include red marks and rounded objects on rock formations. Another painting is in the shape of a hand. Making the image of the hand involves many steps, Hoffmann and the other researchers noted. This led them to decide that it was a slow, thoughtful creation. The second study attempted to identify the age of shells that had been colored and cut in another cave in southeast Spain. Researchers studied rock that had formed above where the shells were found. Their investigation found that the shells were around 115,000 years old. This is about 20,000 to 40,000 years older than comparable artifacts linked to Homo sapiens. Those objects were found in Africa or Western Asia. Researchers said the findings show that Neanderthals and Homo sapiens shared similar thinking. They said this suggests the two species were not all that different in their mental ability. Undoubtedly, it is showing Neanderthals were thinking and behaving just like modern humans, said University of Southampton professor Alistair Pike. We should no longer think of them as different species, just humans in different places, he added. Pike helped to prepare a report on the studies. Some experts have yet to be persuaded by the findings. Harold Dibble, an archaeologist at the University of Pennsylvania, studies Neanderthal behavior. He wondered if the coloring and holes in the seashells could have happened naturally. He also said he would like to see the dating on the cave artwork confirmed by another lab. I'm Phil Dierking.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On a cold and cloudy day in March of 1861, Abraham Lincoln became the 16th President of the United States. In his inaugural speech, the new president announced the policy that he would follow toward the southern states that had left the Union. Lincoln said, no state had a legal right to secede. The Union could not be broken. He said he would enforce federal laws in every state. And he promised not to surrender any federal property in the states that seceded. Lincoln said if force was necessary to protect the Union, then force would be used. His policy was soon tested. Jack Weitzel and Jack Moyles discussed the dispute over the federal base that was being built at Fort Sumter.
On his second day as president, Lincoln received some bad news from Fort Sumter at Charleston, South Carolina. Major Robert Anderson, the commander of the small United States force at Sumter, wrote that his food supplies were low. At most, said Anderson, there was enough food for 40 days. Unless he and his men received more supplies, they would have to leave the fort. Lincoln wanted to keep Fort Sumter. It was one of the few United States forts in the South still held by federal forces, and he had promised not to give up any federal property in the states that seceded.
But getting food to Fort Sumter would be a very difficult job. The fort was built on an island in Charleston Harbor. It was surrounded by southern artillery. Southern gunboats guarded the port. To get supplies to Anderson and his men, a ship would have to fight its way to Sumter. Such a battle was sure to begin a bitter civil war. There also was the danger that fighting would cause slave states still in the Union to secede and join the Southern Confederacy.
The Army Chief, General Scott, warned Lincoln that it was too late to get supplies to Fort Sumter. He said southern defenses around the fort were so strong that a major military effort would be necessary. He said it would take months to prepare the warships and soldiers for such an effort. Major Anderson and his men at Sumter, he said, could not wait that long. There was another plan, however, that might work. It was proposed to Lincoln by Captain Gustavus Fox of the Navy Department. Captain Fox said soldiers and supplies could be sent down to Charleston in ships. Outside the entrance to the harbor, on a dark night, they could be put into small boats and pulled by tugs to the fort. Fox said a few warships could be sent to prevent southern gunboats from interfering.
Lincoln liked this plan. He asked his cabinet for advice. If it were possible to send supplies to Sumter, he asked, would it be wise to do so? Postmaster General Blair was the only member of the cabinet to answer yes. Treasury Secretary Chase was for the plan only if Lincoln was sure it would not mean war. Secretary of State Seward and the others opposed it. They said it would be better to withdraw Major Anderson and his men. They felt that now was not the time to start a civil war. This opposition in the cabinet caused Lincoln to postpone action on the Fox Plan. But he sent two men separately to Charleston to get him information on the situation there. One was Captain Fox. The other was a close friend, Ward Lamon.
In Charleston, Fox met with Governor Pickens. He explained that he wished to talk with Major Anderson, not to give him orders, but to find out what the situation really was. Governor Pickens agreed. A Confederate boat carried Fox to Sumter. Anderson told Fox that the last of the food would be gone on April 15th. Ward Lamon went to Charleston after Fox returned to Washington. He, too, met with Governor Pickens and Major Anderson. The South Carolina governor asked Lamon to give Lincoln this message. Nothing can prevent war except a decision by the President of the United States to accept the secession of the South. If an attempt is made to put more men in Fort Sumter, a war cry will be sounded from every hilltop and valley in the South. Lamon reported to Lincoln that the arrival of even a boatload of food at Sumter would lead to fighting.
At the end of March, Lincoln held another cabinet meeting and again asked what should be done about Fort Sumter. Should an attempt be made to get supplies to Major Anderson? This time, three members of the cabinet voted yes and three voted no. When the meeting ended, Lincoln wrote an order for the Secretary of War. He told him to prepare to move men and supplies by sea to Fort Sumter. He said they should be ready to sail as early as April 6th, only 1 week away.
On April 4th, Lincoln called Captain Fox to the White House. He told him that the government was ready to take supplies to Fort Sumter. He said Fox would lead the attempt. Lincoln showed Fox a message he was sending to Governor Pickens in South Carolina. It read, "This is to inform you that an attempt will be made to supply Fort Sumter with food only. If this attempt is not opposed, no effort will be made to throw in men, arms, or ammunition." Governor Pickens received the message on April 8th. He immediately sent it by telegraph to Confederate President Jefferson Davis at Montgomery, Alabama. Davis called a meeting of his cabinet to discuss what should be done. He asked if Fort Sumter should be seized before supplies could arrive.
Former United States Senator Robert Toombs of Georgia was the Confederate Secretary of State. He told Davis, "Firing upon that fort will begin a civil war greater than any the world has ever seen. I cannot advise you." Later in the meeting, Toombs urged Davis not to attack the fort. "Mr. President," he said, "at this time it is suicide, murder, and will lose us every friend in the North. You will strike a hornet's nest which extends from mountains to oceans. Millions now quiet will swarm out and sting us to death. It is not necessary. It puts us in the wrong. It will kill us."
On April 10th, Jefferson Davis sent his decision to the Confederate commander at Charleston, General Pierre Beauregard. He told Beauregard to demand the surrender of Fort Sumter. If Major Anderson refused, then the general was to destroy the fort. The surrender demand was carried to Sumter the next day by a group of Confederate officers. They said Anderson and his men must leave the fort, but they could take with them their weapons and property. And they were offered transportation to any United States port they named.
Anderson rejected the demand. As he walked with the Confederate officers back to their boat, he asked if General Beauregard would open fire on Sumter immediately. "No," they said. "He would be told later when the shooting would start." Anderson then told the Southerners, "If you do not shell us to pieces, hunger will force us out in a few days." General Beauregard informed the Confederate government in Montgomery that Anderson refused to surrender. He also reported the major's statement that Sumter had only enough food for a few more days.
New orders were sent to Beauregard. Jefferson Davis said there was no need to attack the fort if hunger would soon force the United States soldiers to leave. But he said Anderson must say exactly when he and his men would leave. And he said Anderson must promise not to fire on Confederate forces. If Anderson agreed to this, then Confederate guns would remain silent. This offer was carried to Fort Sumter a few minutes before midnight, April 11th. Anderson discussed the offer with his officers and then wrote his answer. He would leave the fort on April 15th if the Confederates made no hostile act against Fort Sumter or against the United States flag. He would not leave, however, if before then he received new orders or supplies.
This did not satisfy the three Confederate officers who brought Beauregard's message. They handed Anderson a short note. It said, "We have the honor to inform you that General Beauregard will open fire on Fort Sumter in 1 hour, at 20 minutes after 4, on the morning of April 12, 1861. The major shook hands with Beauregard's representatives, and they left the fort. Anderson and his officers woke their men and told them to prepare for battle. At Fort Johnson, across the harbor, Confederate gunners also were getting ready. These men would fire the first shot at Sumter. That explosion would signal the other guns surrounding the fort to open fire."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.